You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Manifestations of Karma. This is Lecture 6, which is entitled Karma in Relation to Accidents, given in Hamburg on the 21st of May, 1910. It is easily understood that karmic law can operate when, in the sense demonstrated, a cause of illness asserts itself from within the human being. But it is more difficult to understand that the experiences and actions of a previous life, brought in by the individual at birth, can provoke illnesses coming from outside in a certain sense, such illnesses as science calls infections. Nevertheless, if we go deeper into the true nature of karma, we shall learn not merely to understand how these external causes can be related to the experiences and deeds of earlier lives, but we shall also learn that accidents which befall us, events which we are prone to describe as chance, may be closely related to the course of a previous life. We must indeed penetrate somewhat deeper into the whole nature of man's being if we wish to understand the conditions that are so veiled by our human outlook. We saw yesterday how chance or accident always presents the external event in a veiled form, because in those instances where we speak of chance, the external deceptions created by the Ahrimanic powers are the greatest possible. Now, let us examine in detail how such accidents, that is to say, those events that are generally called, in quotes, accidents, come about. Here it is necessary to bear in mind the law, the truth, the recognition that in life much of what we describe as arising from within, or as, quote, derived from the inner being of man, close quote, is already clothed in illusion. Because if we truly rise above illusion, we find that much of what we at first believed to have originated within man must be described as streaming in from outside. We always encounter this when we have to deal with those dispositions, those traits of character, which are summed up under the name of hereditary characteristics. It seems as though these hereditary characteristics are a part of us only because our forebears had them. And it may appear to us in the most eminent degree as though they had fallen to our lot through no fault of our own, and without our cooperation. It is easy to arrive at a mistaken distinction between what we have brought from earlier incarnations and what we have inherited from our parents and forebears. When we reincarnate, we do not come haphazardly to such and such parents or to such and such a country. There are reasons for all of this, and these relate to our innermost being. Even in those hereditary characteristics which have nothing to do with illness, we must not assume anything haphazard. In the case of a family such as Bach's, for instance, which produced numerous musicians over many generations, in Bach's family more than 20 more or less gifted musicians were born, one might easily assume a pure line of inheritance, where certain characteristics are inherited and where the individual, due to the presence of these characteristics, develops certain abilities preserved from previous incarnations into musical talent. This is not so, however. The facts are quite different. Suppose that someone has the opportunity of receiving many musical impressions in a life between birth and death, that these musical impressions passed him by in this life for the simple reason that he did not have a musical ear. Other impressions which he receives in this life do not pass him by in the same way, because he has organs so formed that he can transform the experiences and impressions into capacities of his own. Here we can say that a person has impressions in the course of his life which are capable of being transformed into capacities and talents through the disposition which he has brought with him from his last birth. And he has other impressions, which on account of his general karma, because he has not received the suitable powers, he cannot transform into the corresponding capacities. They remain, they are stored up, and in the period between death and a new birth, they are converted into the particular tendency to be expressed in the next incarnation. And this tendency leads the person to seek for reincarnation in a particular family, which can provide him with the suitable organs. Thus, if someone has received a great many musical impressions and was unable to transform them into musical capacities or the ability to enjoy music because of an unmusical ear, it will be this inability which will call forth a tendency in his soul to come into a family where he will inherit a musical ear. From this we shall now see that if a certain family inherits a certain construction of the ear, which can be inherited just as well as the external shape of the nose, all those individuals who in consequence of their former incarnation long for a musical ear will strive to come into this family. This shows us that in fact a person has not inherited a musical ear or a similar gift in a particular incarnation, in quotes, by chance, but that he is looked for and actually sought for the inherited characteristic. If we observe such a person from the moment of his birth, it will seem to us as though the musical sense were within him, a quality of his inner being. If, however, we extend our investigation to the time before his birth, we shall find that the musical ear for which he had to seek is something that has come to him from outside. Before his birth or conception, the musical ear was not within him. There was only an impulse urging him to acquire such an ear. In this case, the person has drawn to himself something external. Before reincarnation, the feature which is later termed hereditary was something external. It approached the person, and he hastened to take it. At the moment of incarnation, it became internal and made its appearance within. Thus, in speaking of hereditary disposition, we suffer from a delusion, because we do not take into account the time when the inner quality was an external one. Let us now inquire whether what we have just discussed might also apply to external events that occur in our life between birth and death. In other words, whether something external could be transformed into something internal. To answer this question, we need to go even deeper into the nature of illness and health. I have characterized illness and health from many different angles, and you are aware that I refrain from giving definitions, but rather try to describe things by building up a picture of their various characteristics by which they may be understood. So let us now expand on this picture by adding some further characteristics. We must compare sickness and health with something that appears in normal life, namely sleeping and waking, and we shall then find something of still greater significance. What is taking place within a human being when the daily states of sleeping and waking succeed one another? We know that when we sleep, the physical and the etheric bodies are abandoned by the astral body and the eye, and that awakening represents the return of the astral body and capital I to the physical and etheric bodies. Every morning on waking, all that constitutes our inner being, astral body and I, dives down again into our physical and etheric bodies. What happens in relation to what we experience on falling asleep and waking up? If we consider the moment of going to sleep, we see that all experiences which, from morning to night, fluctuated in our lives, especially the soul experiences of joy and sorrow, happiness and pain, passions, mental images, and so forth, sink down into the subconscious. In normal life, when asleep, we ourselves are unconscious. Why do we lose consciousness when we fall asleep? We know that during the state of sleep we are surrounded by a spiritual world, just as in the waking state we are surrounded by the objects and facts of the physical world of the senses. Why do we not perceive this spiritual world? Because in normal life, to see the spiritual facts and spiritual beings surrounding us at the present stage of human development, between going to sleep and awakening, would prove dangerous in the highest degree. If the human being today were to pass over consciously into the world which surrounds him between going to sleep and awakening, his astral body, which gained its full development in the ancient moon period, would flow out into the spiritual world. But this could not be done by the capital I, which can be developed only during the earth period, and which will have completed its evolution at the end of the earth period. The I is not sufficiently developed to be able to unfold the whole of its activity between falling asleep and awakening. If we were to fall asleep consciously, the condition of our I could be illustrated as follows. Let us suppose that we have a small drop of colored liquid. We drop this into a basin of water and allow it to mix. The color of that small drop will no more be seen because it is mixed with the whole mass of the water. Something of this nature happens when we leave behind our physical body and etheric body on falling asleep. The latter principles are those which hold together the whole of the human being. As soon as the astral body and I leave the two lower principles, they disperse in all directions, impelled always by this principle of expansion. Thus it would happen that the I would be dissolved, and we should indeed have the pictures of the spiritual world before us, but should not be able to understand them by means of those forces which only the I can bring to bear, the forces of discernment, insight, and so forth. In short, with the consciousness we apply to ordinary life. For the I would be dissolved, and we should be frenzied, torn hither and thither, swimming without individuality and without direction in the sea of astral events and impressions. For this reason, because in the case of the normal person, the I is not sufficiently strong, it reacts upon the astral body and prevents it from entering consciously the spiritual world, which is its true home, until there comes a time when the I will be able to accompany the astral body wherever it may penetrate. Thus there is a good reason for our losing consciousness when we fall asleep. For if it were otherwise, we should not be able to maintain our I. We shall only be able to maintain it sufficiently when our earth evolution is achieved. That is why we are prevented from unfolding the consciousness of our astral body. The very reverse takes place when we wake up. When we wake up and sink down into our physical and etheric bodies, we ought in reality to experience their inner nature. But this does not happen. For at the moment of waking up, we are prevented from regarding the inner nature of our corporeal being, because our attention is immediately directed to external events. Neither our faculty of sight nor our faculty of perception is directed toward penetration of the inner being, but is distracted by the external world. If we were immediately to apply ourselves to our inner being, there would be an exact reversal of the situation that would occur if we fell asleep and entered the spiritual world with our ordinary consciousness. Everything spiritual that we had acquired through our I in the course of our earth life would then concentrate, and after our re-entry into the physical and etheric bodies, it would act upon them most powerfully, bringing about a tremendous increase of our egotism. We should sink down with our I and all the passions, the desires, the greed, and the egotism of which we are capable. We should sink down with our I and all the passions, the desires, the greed, and the egotism of which we are capable would be concentrated within this I. All this egotism would pour away into the life of the senses. To prevent this, we are distracted by the external world and barred from penetrating our inner being with our consciousness. This is also confirmed by the accounts of those mystics who attempted to penetrate the innermost being of man. Consider Meister Eckhart, Johannes Tauler, and other mystics of the Middle Ages, who, in order to descend into their own inner being, dedicated themselves to a state in which their attention and interest was entirely turned away from the external world. Read the biographies of many saints and mystics who tried to descend into their inner selves. What was their experience? Temptations, tribulations, and similar experiences which they have depicted in vivid colors. This is what emerged from the compressed astral body and I as an opposing force. That is why all those who, as mystics, have attempted to descend into the inner self found that the further they descended, the more they were impelled to an extinguishing of their I. Meister Eckhart found an excellent word to describe this descending into his own inner self. He spoke of, quote, unbecoming, close quote, that is to say, the extinction of the I. And we read in the Theologia Germanica how the author describes the mystic path into the inner human being, and how he insists that he who wishes to descend will act no longer through his own I, but that Christ, with whom he is fully permeated, will act within him. Such mystics sought to extinguish their I. Not they themselves, but Christ within them should think, feel, and will, so that there may not emerge what dwells within them in the form of passion, desire, and greed, but rather that which streams into them as Christ. That is why St. Paul says, not I, but Christ in me. We can describe the processes of waking up and falling asleep as inner experiences of the human being, awakening as a sinking down of the compressed I into the corporeality of man, and falling asleep as a liberation from consciousness, because we are not yet ready to see that world into which we penetrate on falling asleep. In that sense, we can conceive of waking and sleeping as we need to conceive of many other phenomena of life, as the interpenetration of the various members of the human being. Looking at a person in the state of being awake, we can say, quote, in the state of being awake, four members are present, the physical body, the etheric body, the astral body, and the I. They interpenetrate in a particular way. And in what does this result? In the state of being awake, close quote. For a human being could not be awake if it were not for his capacity to descend into his body in such a way that his attention is deflected by the outside world. The human condition of being awake is dependent on a very specifically coordinated cooperation of his four members. And in like manner, the condition of being asleep depends on the proper separation of these members. It is not enough to state that the human being consists of physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I. Really, to understand the human being, we need to know how the various members are related to one another in a particular state of being, how they interpenetrate. This is essential to our understanding human nature. We tend to regard the way the various members are configured during the state of waking as the normal condition. Let us now start from this assumption of the waking state as the normal condition. Most of you will remember that the consciousness we have at present as earthly people between birth and death is only one of many possible forms of consciousness. If you study Tidal Occult Science or the earlier essays entitled Cosmic Memory, you will find that today's consciousness is one stage among seven different stages of consciousness, and that our present-day consciousness has evolved from three different stages which preceded it, and that it will develop into three further stages of consciousness in the future. During his time on Old Moon, man had not developed the eye. The eye only united with the human being in the course of the Earth period. Therefore, the present form of consciousness only became available to man during the Earth period. For our present form of consciousness between birth and death, the eye must cooperate with the other three members in exactly the way it does today, and it must be the highest member out of the four principles that constitutes the human being. Before the human being was impregnated with the eye, he consisted merely of physical body, etheric body, and astral body. His highest member was the astral body, and his consciousness was something like that which we have retained as an ancient inheritance in our dream consciousness. However, you must not imagine our present-day dream consciousness, but one which conveyed realities through the images of dreams. If we study the dream as it is today, we shall find in its manifold images much that is chaotic, because our present dream consciousness is an ancient inheritance. But if we study the consciousness that preceded that of today, we should find that we could not, at that time, see external objects, such as plants, for instance. Thus it was impossible for us to receive an external impression. Anything that approached us evoked an impression analogous to that of a dream, but corresponded to a certain external object or impression. Thus the eye consciousness was preceded by a consciousness related to the astral body, which was the highest member. This astral consciousness was dim and nebulous, and not yet irradiated by the light of the eye. When the human being became Earth Man, this astral consciousness was outshone by the eye consciousness. The astral body, however, is still within us, and we might ask how it was that our astral consciousness could be so dimmed and eliminated that the eye consciousness could fully take its place. This became possible because, through our impregnation by the eye, the earlier connection between the astral body and the etheric body was greatly loosened. The earlier and more intimate connection was, so to speak, loosened up. Thus, before the eye consciousness, there existed a far more intimate relationship between our astral body and the lower members of our being. The astral body penetrated further into the other members than it does today. In a certain respect, the astral body has been wrested from the etheric and physical bodies. We must be quite clear about this process of the partial exit, this detachment, as it were, of the astral body from the etheric and physical bodies. Then the question will arise whether it might be possible today, with our normal eye consciousness, to establish something similar to this ancient relationship. Could it not happen also today in a human life that the astral body tries to penetrate further into the other members than it ought, to impregnate and penetrate more than is its due? There is, in fact, a certain normal measure for this penetration of the astral body into the etheric and physical bodies. If this is exceeded in one or the other direction, certain disturbances in the whole of the human organism will result from this. For what the human being is today depends upon that exact relationship between the various principles of his being which we find in a normal waking state. As soon as the astral body acts wrongly, as soon as it penetrates deeper into the etheric and physical bodies, there will be disorder. In our past discussions, we saw that this really takes place. We then looked at the whole process from another aspect. When does this happen? It happens when, in an earlier life, the human being impregnated his astral body with something, allowed something to flow into it that we conceive of as a moral or intellectual transgression for that earlier life. This has been engraved on the astral body. When a person enters life anew, this may in fact cause the astral body to seek a different relationship with the physical and etheric bodies than it would have sought had it not, in the preceding life, been impregnated with this transgression. Thus are the transgressions committed under the influence of Ahriman and Lucifer transformed into organizing forces which, in a new life, induce the astral body to adopt a different relationship toward the physical and etheric bodies than would be the case had such forces not intervened. So we see how earlier thoughts, sensations, and feelings affect the astral body and induce it to bring about disorders in the human organism. What happens when such disorders are brought about? When the astral body penetrates further into the physical and etheric bodies than it normally should, it brings about something similar to what takes place when we awaken, when our I sinks down into the two lower principles. Awakening consists in the sinking down of the I principle into the physical and etheric bodies. In what then consists the action of the astral body, when induced by the effects of earlier experiences, it penetrates the physical and etheric bodies further than it should. That which takes place when our I and our astral body sink down into our physical and etheric bodies, when we wake up in the morning and start perceiving things, shows the very fact of our awakening. Just as the state of waking is the result of the descent of the I principle into our physical and etheric bodies, something analogous to that activity of the I must now take place for the astral body. It descends into the etheric body and the physical body. In the case of a person whose astral body has a tendency toward a closer union with the etheric and the physical bodies than should normally take place, we can see the astral body accomplish the phenomenon which we otherwise achieve by the eye upon awakening. What is this excessive penetration of the physical and etheric bodies by the astral body? It constitutes the essence of illness. When our astral body does what we otherwise do upon awakening, namely, pushes its way into the physical body and the etheric body, when the astral body, which normally should not develop any consciousness within us, strives after a consciousness within our physical and etheric bodies, trying to awaken within us, we become ill. Illness is an abnormal waking condition of our astral body. What is it we do when, in normal health, we live in an ordinary waking condition? We are awake in ordinary life. But to achieve the ordinary state of wakefulness, we had to bring our astral body into a different relationship at an earlier stage. We had to put it to sleep. During the day, when our eye consciousness prevails, our astral body needs to sleep. We can be healthy only if our astral body is asleep within us. So we can conceive of the essence of health and illness in the following way. Illness is an abnormal awakening of the astral body within man, and health is the normal sleeping state of the astral body. And what is this consciousness of the astral body? If illness really is the awakening of the astral body, something like a consciousness must be manifested. There is an abnormal awakening, and so we can expect an abnormal consciousness. A consciousness of some kind there must be. When we fall ill, something similar must happen to what occurs when we awake in the morning. Our faculties must be diverted to something different. Our ordinary consciousness awakens in the morning. Does any consciousness arise when we become ill? Yes, there arises a consciousness that we know all too well. And which is this consciousness? A consciousness expresses itself in experiences. The consciousness which then arises is expressed in what we call pain, which we do not have during our waking condition when in ordinary health, because it is then that our astral body is asleep. When our astral body is asleep, it is correctly aligned to our physical and etheric bodies, and that means freedom from pain. Pain tells us that the astral body is pressing into the physical body and the etheric body in an excessive way, and is acquiring consciousness. Such is pain. We must not apply this statement without limits. When we speak in terms of spiritual science, we must put limits to our statements. It has been stated that when our astral body awakens, there arises a consciousness that is steeped in pain. We must not conclude from this that pain and illness invariably go together. Without exception, every penetration into the etheric and physical bodies by the astral body constitutes illness, but the inverse does not hold. That illness may have a different character will be shown by the fact that not every illness is accompanied by pain. Most people take no notice of this because they usually do not strive after health, but are satisfied to be without pain. And when they are without pain, they believe themselves to be healthy. This is not always the case, but generally, in the absence of pain, people will believe themselves to be healthy. We should be under a great delusion if we believed that the experience of pain always coincides with illness. Our liver may be damaged through and through, and if the damage is not such that the abdominal wall is affected, there will be no pain at all. We may carry a process of disease within us, which in no way manifests itself through pain. This may be so in many instances. Objectively regarded, these illnesses are the more serious, for if we experience pain, we set to work to rid ourselves of it. But when we have no pain, we do not greatly trouble to get rid of the disease. What is the position in cases where illness is not accompanied by pain? We need but remember that only little by little did we develop into human beings, such as we are today, and that it was during this earth period that we added the I to the astral body, etheric body, and physical body. Further back, we only possessed etheric body and physical body. A being possessing only these two principles is like a plant of the present day. We meet here a third degree of consciousness, infinitely more vague, which does not attain to the clarity even of today's dream consciousness. It is quite erroneous to believe that we are devoid of consciousness when we sleep. We have a consciousness, but it is so vague that we cannot call it up within our eye to the point of memory. Such a consciousness dwells also within plants. It is a kind of sleep consciousness of a still lower degree than the astral consciousness. We have now reached an even lower degree of human consciousness. Let us suppose that through experiences in previous incarnations, we have brought about not only the kind of disorder in our organization which causes the astral body to excessively penetrate the physical and etheric bodies, but have also done something or other which is liable to push the etheric body into the physical body to an inappropriate degree. It is certainly possible for the relationship between the etheric body and the physical body to become abnormal, for the etheric body to penetrate more deeply into the physical body than is appropriate today. Let us suppose that the astral body is not involved at all, but that the tendency created in an earlier life effects a closer connection than there should be between the etheric body and the physical body in the human organism. In that case, the etheric body acts in the same way as the astral body does when we have pain. If the etheric body, in its turn, penetrates too deeply into the physical body, a consciousness similar to our sleep consciousness arises, something of the nature of plant consciousness. It is not surprising, therefore, that this is a condition of which we are not aware. Anyone unaware of sleep will equally be unaware of this condition. And yet it is a sort of awakening. As our astral body will awake abnormally when it has sunk too deeply into the etheric and physical bodies, so will our etheric body awake in an abnormal manner when it penetrates too deeply into the physical body. But this will not be perceived by us, because it is an awakening to a consciousness even more vague than the consciousness of pain. Let us suppose that a person has really, in an earlier life, done something that between death and a new birth is so transformed that the etheric body itself awakens, that is, it takes intense possession of the physical body. If that happens, there awakes within us a deep consciousness that cannot, however, be perceived in the same manner as other experiences of the human soul. Must it, however, be ineffectual because it is imperceptible? Let us try to explain the peculiar tendency acquired by a consciousness which lies still one degree deeper. If you burn yourself, which is an external experience, this causes pain. If a pain is to appear, the consciousness must have at least the degree of consciousness of the astral body. A pain must be in the astral body. Thus, whenever pain arises in the human soul, we are dealing with an occurrence in the astral body. Now let us suppose something happens which is not connected with pain, but is, however, an external stimulus, an external impression. If something flies into your eye, EYE, this causes an external stimulus and the eye closes. Pain is not connected with it. What does the irritant produce? A movement. This is something similar to what occurs when the sole of your foot is touched. It is not pain, but still the foot twitches. Thus there are also impressions upon a human being which are not accompanied by pain, but which still give rise to some sort of an event, namely a movement. In this case, because he cannot penetrate down into this deep degree of consciousness, the person does not know how it comes about that a movement follows the external stimulus. When you perceive pain and you thereby repulse something, it is the pain which makes you notice that which you then reject. But now, something may come which urges you to an inner movement, to a reflex movement. In this case, the consciousness does not descend to the degree at which the irritant is transformed into movement. Here you have a degree of consciousness which does not come into your astral experience, which is not experienced consciously, which runs its course in a kind of sleep consciousness, but may nevertheless result in certain events. When this deeper penetration of the etheric body into the physical body comes about, it produces a consciousness which is not a pain consciousness, because the astral body takes no part in it, but is so vague that the person does not perceive it. This does not necessarily mean that a person in this state of consciousness is not able to act in a way appropriate to the situation. After all, people act in all sorts of ways that do not involve their consciousness. Just think of cases where the ordinary day consciousness is extinguished and all sorts of acts are performed, such as during sleepwalking. In a case like this, there is no absence of consciousness, but rather a kind of consciousness which the person cannot share in, because he can only experience the two higher forms of consciousness, the astral consciousness as pleasure and pain and so on, and the capital I consciousness as judgment and as ordinary day consciousness. This does not imply that a human being cannot act out of this sleep consciousness. So, we also have a consciousness which is so deep that we cannot reach it anymore when our etheric penetrates into our physical body. Let us assume a case where someone affected in this way, nevertheless, wishes to do something of which he knows nothing in ordinary life and which is connected with the situation in some way. He will then do it without becoming aware of it. Something within him, namely the thing itself, will do it, and he himself will know nothing about it. Let us now consider a person who, through certain occurrences in an earlier life, has attracted certain causes which, during the period between death and a new birth, result in a deeper penetration of the etheric into the physical body. In consequence, the person concerned will do things which will result in deep-seated disease processes. The person will be urged actually to seek out external causes of illness. It may seem strange that such things do not become clear to the normal eye consciousness. However, no one would do that out of their normal eye consciousness. Nobody would command themselves to seek out sites of infection out of their normal eye consciousness. But if we assume that the dim consciousness referred to considers it necessary for an outer damage to occur, and for what we have termed the meaning of illness yesterday to come into play, then this consciousness which penetrates into the physical body will seek for the cause of illness. It is man's own being which seeks for the cause of illness in order to set in motion what we called the process of illness yesterday. So you will understand, out of the deeper nature of illness, that counter-effects occur even when there is as yet no pain. And when there is pain, and the etheric body penetrates too deeply into the physical body, a seeking of external causes of illness by deeper layers of human consciousness may result. It may sound grotesque, but is nevertheless true. Just as we search for our inherited characteristics, we search for our outer causes of illness when we need them, with a different degree of consciousness. However, what I have just described only applies within the limits stated today. My main objective today was to show that a human being may be capable, without being able to follow the process with his familiar consciousness, of searching for an illness through producing an abnormal and lower state of consciousness. We learned that illness implies the awakening of stages of consciousness, which as human beings we have long overcome. Our transgressions in an earlier life make us bring forth levels of consciousness lower than what is appropriate to our present life. And what we do out of the impulses of such levels of consciousness affects the course of the disease process, as well as the process which leads to illness in the first place. This shows us that in such abnormal states, old stages of consciousness arise, which human beings overcame a long time ago. If you just look at everyday life a little more closely, you will gain a clearer picture of what has been described today. It is a fact that pain makes us descend more deeply into our being. You will be aware of the saying that we only know that we have a particular organ when it has begun to hurt us. It is a popular saying, but there is wisdom in it. Why do we know nothing about it in our ordinary consciousness? Because, normally, our consciousness is asleep to an extent where it does not penetrate deeply enough into our astral body. Then, when it does penetrate, pain arises, and this pain brings the respective organ to our awareness. In that way, many popular expressions contain real wisdom, since they represent heirlooms from earlier stages of consciousness, when man was still able to gaze into the spiritual world and know much of what we have to acquire with great effort today. Once you understand that human beings are capable of experiencing deeper layers of consciousness, you will also find it possible to understand that human beings may not only seek for external causes of illness, but also for strokes of destiny, which may seem without reason, but whose reason works into deeper layers of consciousness. So one might well think that a person would not ordinarily place himself where lightning will strike him. With his ordinary consciousness, he will avoid doing so. But there may be active within him a consciousness that lies deeper than his ordinary consciousness and will lead him to the very place where lightning may strike him, from out of a foresight which his ordinary consciousness lacks. A consciousness which wills the lightning to strike him and makes him seek out this accident. We have now learned that it is possible to seek out accidents or outer causes of illness due to karmic effects. In due course, we will deal with the details of such processes, such as the way in which the forces in deeper levels of consciousness work within the human being, or to what extent our ordinary consciousness may avoid such accidents. We can understand that someone who goes to a place where he may succumb to an infection will have been driven there under the influence of a certain level of consciousness. In like manner, we must be able to understand how it is that human beings take certain measures to render such infections less and less effective. In other words, that through our ordinary consciousness, we are able to avert certain consequences by means of hygiene. We can grasp the possibility of counteracting certain effects by means of our ordinary consciousness. And we must concede that it would be most unreasonable if our subconscious was capable of seeking out disease-bringing germs if causes of illness could not be avoided through our ordinary consciousness. We shall see that it is reasonable to seek out disease-bringing germs, and that it is also reasonable to introduce certain measures of hygiene against infection from out of our ordinary consciousness in order to avoid causes of illness. The end of Lecture 6.